I'm Atlas.
And I'm Sheba.
And this is the Relationship Umbrella.
So, today we have decided we are going to talk about ethical non-monogamy, kind of breaking off of what we decided to talk about last week, which was monogamy versus non-monogamy. Just to kind of give you the rundown of what we're going to talk about today, ethical non-monogamy is the practice of taking part in romantic relationships that are not completely exclusive between two people. While this isn't really like the default or societal norm that we see, it's definitely grown in popularity over the years. And I think it's important to talk about because there are more ethical non-monogamy practicing people out there than you'd think there would be.
And we want to bring to light ethical non-monogamy a little bit as well as a form of a healthy relationship because it's ethical.
Right.
Just because it's non-monogamous doesn't mean that it's not ethical. Doesn't mean that it's not helpful and growth-inducing, so to speak.
Right, exactly. And one thing we want you to remember, too, when we're talking about this is, you know, this isn't everything that we're going to talk about today. You know, there are so many other things that we're going to talk about. This is not like
the end all be all of ethical non-monogamy relationship
right.
style.
This isn't like an exhaustive list. Like, this is it. This is all we have to talk about. There's definitely so much more out there. This is just kind of us talking about the tip of the iceberg.
Absolutely.
So
here's our non-exhaustive list. I will start. Obviously, the big one that most people know about in ethical non-monogamy is polyamory. It's basically an approach to a relationship wherein people could have multiple romantic or sexual relationships at the same time. I really want to make sure that we understand the deviation because not all relationships that are romantic will be sexual. There are asexual people out there. There are demisexual people out there and people who want to participate in polyamory without necessarily sleeping with all their partners or any of their partners. And that's the beauty of polyamory, is that you can have multiple partners and each partner will fit a different need.
Right.
So polyamory is what we practice. We practice a form of polyamory. And polyamory, the big thing too about polyamory is there are multiple types of polyamory, some of which we'll cover in this list.
Absolutely. And just another thing I want to bring up on the subject of polyamory is there's also polygamy, which is the practice of one husband having multiple wives.
And polyandry, which is the practice of one wife having multiple husbands.
And this, again, can be ethical or unethical.
Unethical.
Any relationship style has the capacity to be unethical, depending on the people. Yeah. Okay? But just as like a... Anyway.
Side note.
The next thing kind of want to talk about, and this is something I've been seeing a lot about recently, and it's interesting the different takes that a lot of people have on this. I've read quite a number of blog posts and articles about something called relationship anarchy, which is just kind of broken down an approach to relationships that's usually non-hierarchical.
Hierarchical.
Thank you. Where there's no set rules or expectations other than the ones that the involved partners agree upon. There's a lot of different definitions that a lot of different people have when it comes to relationship anarchy and what that means. But just in everything that I've read personally, that's kind of like the basest definition of it. Mm. So if you want to break that down even further, there's no set rules or expectations other than the ones that partners agree upon. So it can be something as simple as, I don't care what you do, this, that, and the other, but I'd rather
to know when you like catch feelings for somebody or before you have sex with somebody.
Or make sure you don't have sex in our bed. Like, I guess little things like that. It's definitely just another form of anarchy. It's just relationship anarchy. It's what you make it.
Absolutely.
So.
And, you know, with kind of building upon that, relationship anarchy is typically non-hierarchical. we're going to talk now a little tiny bit about hierarchical relationships. The big thing with a hierarchical relationship in ethical non-monogamy is that there's usually one main relationship that is, or a set of relationships that are primary. That primary partners is usually a couple. Sometimes it's a triad where there's, you know, three people in almost a monogamous relationship with each other, but they are free to see other people or have secondary partners. Relationship anarchists in general tend to not participate in hierarchical relationships because there's established levels, it feels like, and it might seem like the secondary partner isn't as important as the primary partner. Myself and Chiba have been in a hierarchical relationship in the past where she was married to her wife, and that was her primary partner, and I was her secondary partner. And I can tell you from personal experience, when those communication lines start to break down, which they did at one point, which is why it's just me and Chiba now and no more wife, one partner can take that in a hierarchical situation and make it unethical.
Absolutely. I hated practicing hierarchical.
Same.
I hated it. I hated it. And I thought it was the only way to practice. And it is not.
It is not.
Even my relationship prior to my ex-wife, my ex-boyfriend, he was all about this where, you know, we were the important relationship and we would only ever bring girls in. And there was only the expectation of the triad, which was very unicorn hunted. That's like what he did.
Yeah.
But he used it as a way to just, you know, interact with other women. And there was a whole big mess, but I hated practicing this way. And I'm so grateful that we don't practice hierarchy now, because it's super invalidating to any other partners that you might have.
And I can tell you from experience that it absolutely feels invalidating. It makes you feel like your relationship with the person who has a primary partner, that you're not as important as the primary partner. No matter how hard Chiba tried to make me feel like I was just equally as important, things would happen where other partner would call off work when we had a date and tag along, and all of a sudden I'm the third wheel on what was supposed to be a date between Chiba and myself, which is why I say that relationship was unethical, because there were certain lines that were crossed that weren't agreed upon by any of us, or I wasn't consulted in some of these things. And that wasn't Chiba's fault. It was absolutely not a healthy relationship. Where hierarchical relationships can be healthy, the biggest thing for a hierarchical relationship to be healthy is communication, and we are going to talk a lot about communication and communication styles and love languages in our next episode. So that brings us to
polyfidelity. So polyfidelity is a relationship between a group of people where all members are equal in the relationship, and no one has sex or dates people outside of the relationship. So think of polyfidelity as what you would consider an exclusive monogamous relationship, but with more people. So triads, groups of three people being in a
they're polyfidelity. They are
established.
Yeah.
Relationship where no one dates outside. There's quads, which are groups of four. There are Vs, which is a three-person relationship where one person is dating two people, but those two people aren't dating each other. And that can be a form of polyfidelity where you don't take any other partners. You know, you are exclusive to the people that you are with. And nobody in the relationship can date outside of that. That's kind of what polyfidelity is. But it's a choice. It's not like, oh, no, like you're dating me. No, now you can't date other people. That's unethical. Polyfidelity is ethical as long as you communicate with all of your partners that this is what you want and this is what you agree upon.
And everybody is in agreement that they're going to be fidelity, I guess, have a fidelitous relationship.
Fidelitous
with each other instead of being infidelitous, so to speak.
Right.
And that kind of brings us to open relationships.
A little bit.
Because when you have polyfidelity, people grow and people change. So let's say we have three people that are in a polyfidelitous relationship with each other. And one of them in the relationship goes, you know what? I met this really cool person and I'd like to open up our relationship. That then becomes an open relationship because mm-hmm. they've agreed upon opening up the relationship, which means that anybody in that relationship can date other people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where communication again will come into play. Open relationships is basically when a couple or a set of partners are open to new romantic or sexual partners.
It's kind of more of a general.
Yeah, it's very general. I mean, if you want to be technical, you know, me and Sheba, we're polyamorous, but we are both right now in a place where our relationship is open because we can both seek out other partners. That's where we're at. We were polyfidelitous, I would say, for the last year and a half,
mm-hmm.
maybe 2 years. And now we're at a point where we definitely have different needs that we need met mm-hmm. that one isn't meeting for the other person. And that doesn't mean that our relationship is invalid or that somebody's coming up short. That just means that maybe, I'll use cooking as an example. Maybe I really want to have onions and mushrooms and soups and, you know, weird foods that Sheba just really isn't into. And Sheba wants to have pizza and pasta and, you know, some of the foods that she might be more into. And
call me out.
Right, I know. that would have been a good point for the ba-doom sound. But definitely, like, if that's a good way to look at it with food, because everybody has food preferences and food cooking styles, and maybe Sheba doesn't like when I cook or eat these certain types of foods, so she wants to go and eat and cook other foods. You know? So it gives you that option to seek out other people to meet needs that your other partner isn't meeting because they just maybe don't want to.
And I'll say it truthfully, Atlas and I, our relationship is the strongest it's been up to this point.
Absolutely.
And the fact that we decided to open up our relationship mm-hmm. through that strength says a lot about our relationship as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that open up their relationships to try and fix what is wrong, which is unethical. But when you open up your relationship kind of for the reasons like Atlas and I are, that's ethical. We've talked about it. We've mm-hmm. decided upon it. This is what we want to pursue. So,
right. And I know what needs. I'm very aware of what needs I'm not meeting for Sheba. And I think she's very aware of needs that she's not meeting for me, which really isn't any, truthfully. But I have enough love to give that I would like to have other partners too. Whereas I'm borderline asexual, and she was definitely not borderline asexual.
I'm definitely probably hypersexual.
So there's needs there that it's not that I'm unwilling to meet. I would absolutely have sex with Sheba whenever we feel up to it. But I have some trauma from my past that makes that hard for me from time to time. So if she can find a connection with somebody who's healthy for her, that is okay that she's with somebody else and can meet those needs for her, there you go.
Problem solved. Sorry, I was taking a sip of my coffee. That was poor timing.
My turn.
Anyway, kind of leading from opening up a relationship to casual dating or casual sex. This is essentially when people casually date and have sex with multiple people, with everyone knowing that it's happening and nothing is really super serious. It's casual, hence casual dating or casual sex. With this, everyone knows it's happening. You know, let's say you go on a date with someone new and you tell them, you know, I am seeing multiple people. Nothing is really serious right now. I am having sex with these people. Are you okay with that? And it's very just ebb and flow.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I like to think of like casual dating or casual sex. It's very ebb and flow.
Absolutely.
I did have a stint where I was having casual sex with someone. It did not last very long because it is definitely not for me, but that's the best way I can describe it. Ebb and flow.
Ebb and flow. I like that.
I don't know how else to say it. That's the simplest way to say it. So it's very case in point.
Yeah. And that kind of leads us to threesomes. A lot of times you'll see threesomes happen where you've got an established couple and they bring in a third person to have sex with them, either for a one-night stand or regularly for casual threesomes. So you can kind of incorporate that casual sex into your relationship. The thing with threesomes that that can make them become unethical kind of goes to unicorn hunting. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that will, a male partner will seek out another female partner and go, hey, let's go on a date. They go on a date. Well, I have a wife or I have a girlfriend and we really just want to have sex with you. You know, so they seek out people with that person's understanding that it's a date, and then they get to the date, and all of a sudden they're being approached for casual sex. Some people respond great to that. Some people don't. The lying at the beginning and not being open about what you're looking for in that third person is where it becomes unethical.
It's, you got to be open straight out from the gate if you want to have ethical threesomes. If you just want a woman to come into your straight seeming relationship just to have sex with you guys every now and then, make that known right out the gate. We are just looking for sex.
We don't want a relationship with you. We just want you to come into our bedroom and have fun once in a while.
Exactly. Where unicorn hunting can kind of go into that unethically.
Yep.
Unicorn hunting and dragon hunting is more along the lines. It's definitely unethical. Unless you're in a place where people are looking for that. But
there are people who look for that type of relationship, they want to be the unicorn, they want to be right. The dragon. And you can actually see that in media. Mm-hmm. If you look at, you know, Seeking Sister Wives, that show, there's a polygamous family that is looking for a sister wife to come into the family that will sleep with only the husband and not with the other sister wives. And these women are seeking to be sister wives. That is ethical.
That's ethical. Going into unethical is where you're not honest about it. Mm-hmm. And anyway, kind of leading from threesomes though, back into ethical land over here is swinging, where a lot of people think, and this is just a generalized kind of what I've seen out of the public and out of people I know, where when you say you're polyam, people are like, oh, so you swing. Swinging can absolutely be ethical, but polyamory and ethical non-monogamy, polyamory is not swinging and vice versa. Swinging is when a couple has sex with another couple and or swaps partners. That's what swinging is.
I actually have experience with swinging, by the
way. Do you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Finish your story and I'll
That's all I got, so explain your story.
Oh, okay. So, I was actually involved with a couple, just for threesomes once in a while, and all three of us decided to bring in another couple, and we all kind of swapped. That's a lot of personal information about me. That's five people in one room having sex. It's a lot, but there was no relationship or relationship hierarchy, and we were specifically doing this for sexual gratification.
Swinging.
100%.
Ta-da!
Does it have its place in ethical non-monogamy? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Everybody in that room consented to everything that happened. We all had a good time. It was towards the end of the situation where there was a couple things that happened that were unethical that I won't get into because it's super personal, but it involved a breakdown of communication between the two couples that were involved in this particular instance and not me. I was sleeping on the couch when some shit happened. So, but the actual situation, you know, we all talked about it. We set very specific boundaries of what was and was not allowed for each of us. Like, I didn't want to be kissing everybody. For me, kissing is super, super romantic and personal. Mm-hmm. So for me, there was one person in all of these other people that were involved. There was five of us total, including me. There was one person in that group that I was willing to kiss. One. So for me, it was just about having sex with all of these people. Granted, I don't necessarily live that way anymore. Like I said, I'm borderline asexual, but I was definitely in an experimental phase. I was in my early 20s, and we all did some shit in our early 20s, but that to me is my experience in swinging.
Yeah, old man.
Yeah, shut up.
anyway, swinging.
That kind of brings us to cuckolding next. Cuckolding, I didn't realize what it was. I had to Google it. It can also be very ethical, and I actually have seen this happen quite a bit. It's when a couple brings in a third party to have sex with one of the partners, often with the other partner watching. So basically, when you have people that are voyeuristic, so let's say I wanted to be a voyeur and I wanted to see Sheba.
You've done that a number of times. It's all good.
See Sheba be physically intimate with somebody else, and if that somebody else was okay,
it was an exhibitionist
watching, and they wanted to be exhibitionists. That is ethical because we've agreed upon Sheba sleeping with another person while I watch to get my rocks off while they're getting their rocks off. As long as everybody consents, that is a form of ethical non-monogamy because, again, it's non-monogamous.
Everyone consented to it.
Absolutely. And that brings us to...
what is something... that brings us to this. Something called monogamish. Which is a fairly new term to me, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
So, this is a couple that's mostly monogamous, but might occasionally have sex with other people in certain situations. So, exactly what Atlas was just talking about, cuckolding, is monogamish. It's kind of like an umbrella term. It's a vague term that a couple that'll occasionally have sex with other people in certain situations. Threesomes, swinging, that all kind of goes under the umbrella of what would be considered monogamish. So, your romantic relationship is serious and monogamous, but your sexual relationship is not, occasionally, within certain circumstances. That's what monogamish is.
Absolutely. You know, the big thing to remember when talking about any of these types of ethical non-monogamy is that consent and prior knowledge, agreed upon boundaries, and communication are all vital to any of these types of relationships being successful and fulfilling.
You gotta communicate. It's so important. We're gonna drill it into your brains with everything. Communicate. Open up your lines of communication. If you don't feel comfortable talking with a partner or partners about something, mm-hmm. you definitely need to reevaluate yourself, why you don't feel comfortable talking about it. Your partners and why you don't feel comfortable about it, because in any kind of healthy, good relationship, you have to be able to communicate with your partner. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for failure. If you can't open up about things, then it's a moot point.
Absolutely.
You have to be able to do this in any kind of relationship, not just romantic, not just sexual, with your family, with your friends. You have to be able to communicate your feelings to people. You really do.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's why we're going to do a whole episode on communication and different communication styles and what love languages are and how to meet those communicatory needs. But the big thing to remember about this list is it's by no means exhaustive.
And we kind of covered that in the very beginning.
Yeah. So now, we're going to do some... Oh, go ahead.
If you want, just sorry, I'm going to interrupt Atlas for a second. If you want more resources, we can definitely post some links for you guys where we got some of our information from to kind of cite our sources, if you will. So you can read more in depth about some of this.
The big source we used was mindbodygreen.com. It had this particular list.
Yep.
We just expounded upon it with kind of our own viewpoints a little bit on what these different things mean.
But if you want more, absolutely get with us on our Twitter and we will get you some more resources you can look into for ethical non-monogamy. Absolutely. If you need our Twitter is Atlas and the letter N, Sheba, TRU. There you can find us at Twitter and we'll get you some resources up there. We'll also put some resources
on our Facebook page.
And definitely up on our Patreon as a blog post. Any sources that we cite over on our Patreon will be viewable for the public. You don't need to be a patron.
Absolutely.
To get to those sources, because you need to have a place where you can research safely.
If you have any problems locating us at any of our socials, just go to www.therelationshipumbrella.com. And our link tree, all of our links, our episodes, things like that are all on that website as well.
Website!
Yay!
I work so hard on that!
Yay!
But anyway!
So, the next thing I want to do, we are going to try something new. We are going to be doing a news segment and...
a story of the week. We want to engage with you guys a lot more and give you more relevant information.
Absolutely. So, here goes nothing. the news with Atlas. I had to. So, today, we're looking at an article from July 16th, where two transgender Montanans filed a lawsuit Friday against the state over a new law that requires trans people who want to change the gender marker on their identifying documents to prove that they've had genital surgery. The issue with that is that not everybody who transitions has genital surgery. The law signed by Republican Governor Greg Gianforte in April states that the sex designation on a birth certificate can only be changed if the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services, quote, received a certified copy of an order from a court indicating that the sex of an individual born in Montana had been changed by surgical procedure. Again, not every trans person wants to have genital surgery.
Or any kind of surgery.
Exactly.
Not all trans people want to even be on hormones.
And to be frank, do I want to have chest surgery? Absolutely. Have I been transitioning for 12 years without having any surgeries? Absolutely. This lawsuit that was filed Friday was filed by Amelia Marquez, a transgender woman, and John Doe, a transgender man. That's funny. They argue in their lawsuit that the measure violates their constitutional rights to privacy, equal protection of the law, and due process, according to an American Civil Liberties Union statement, which is representing the plaintiffs along with the ACLU of Montana and Nixon Peabody LLP. These two folks have lived in Montana for all their lives. They've done like hormone therapy and counseling, but they can't afford the surgery required by the new law, which is... most insurance companies don't cover these surgeries, and I can tell you from the research that I've done for female-to-male transitioning folks like myself, if you want to have one of the more expensive procedures done where they actually take a full graft, skin, tissue, nerves, and have that made into a phallus...
That's phalloplasty, right?
Yes. That surgery... usually takes 3 to 4 years to come to completion, or 1 to 2, depending upon how fast you heal. And you have to have multiple surgeries, revisions, and there's different options. Do you want to have a vaginectomy? Do you want to have glansplasty? Do you want to have an erectile device implanted? You know, and they all come in stages. You want urethral lengthening so you can urinate out of your phallus. You know, the money that just gets invested in that for the type of surgery that I would want if I were to do it could cost upwards of $40,000 or more. And $40,000 is probably the low end. Chest surgery low end is probably $12,000 to $15,000.
Who in America has that kind of money right now?
Nobody has it just sitting around when you're middle or lower class. Nobody does.
Nobody.
The wealthiest 1% do, but, you know, we're not talking to you guys. No offense. Have your money. But basically, you know, what Marquez says is that my inability to obtain a birth certificate that accurately reflects my female gender identity is a painful and stigmatizing reminder of the state of Montana's refusal to recognize me as a woman. This goes to this, trans women are women. Trans men are men. And trans theys or thems or zees are they, thems, or zees.
Your gender identity is valid.
You are valid. And this law invalidates that. So... nationally, only 25% of transgender and gender nonconforming people reported having undergone some form of transition-related surgery. So that means 75% of trans people don't or haven't had surgery and may not. I do want to say that I did cite this from NBC.com's Out page, and the article of the author is Joe Yerkaba. He also is the article of this next, the author of this next article I want to share about, because this is good news. California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, approved a final state budget on Monday that includes $3 million for LGBTQ cultural competency training for public school teachers.
Yay!
What that means is it makes the state the first in the country to allocate funding in this specific way, according to the Equality California, an LGBTQ advocacy group that has pushed for the training for years. This funding will allow the California Department of Education to develop a curriculum aimed at helping teachers support LGBTQ students.
Fuck yes.
Right? Quote, there's no doubt that our schools must be safe, supportive, and welcoming for all students, Rick Chavez, Executive Director of Equality California, said in a statement. At a time when states across the country are attacking transgender kids, We are elated that California has taken this momentous step toward ensuring that public school teachers and staff have the tools and training they need to support LGBTQ students. The funding is a win for advocates who were disappointed after Governor Jerry Brown, a Democrat, vetoed a similar bill in 2018. At the time, Brown said he had already signed a law that would allow the Department of Education to use its existing resources for cultural competency training if the department determined that teachers needed it, according to the Bay Area Reporter. So this is huge. A national survey published in 2020 by Glessen, G-L-S-E-N, it's a nonprofit group that advocates for LGBTQ students, found that 69% of LGBTQ students reported experience of verbal harassment at school based on their sexual orientation, 57% based on their gender expression or outward appearance, and 54% based on their gender identity. About one-tenth of LGBTQ students report that they had been physically assaulted, punched, kicked, or injured with a weapon in the previous year based on their sexual orientation, gender expression, or gender identity, according to the survey, and more than half, 58%, reported they had been sexually harassed in the previous year. The thing about this is, and it goes on to kind of talk about this a little bit, a hostile school climate absolutely affects the mental health and well-being of our trans and GLBTQ students. Absolutely. Especially if they're victimized at school. They report higher rates of depression, and of those who indicated they were considering dropping out of school, 42% said it related to the harassment they faced. And to be frank, the suicide rate amongst LGBTQ youth when they're being harassed and bullied at school, and especially if it comes not just from their peers, but from their teachers and their superiors, that suicide rate's way higher than it needs to be. We do not need to be living in a country where our young people feel so hopeless that they end their lives.
There's so much to experience, and these are kids. These are children.
Children.
We need to, as a fucking country, do better.
Absolutely.
This is the future of our country. These are children that are ending their lives. Why?
I've read stories of children as young as 9 in the last year.
9? These are kids, people. Kids.
There's no reason that we should have our students coming home, especially if they're coming home to a good family environment, and it's just so bad at school that they give up, because they're at school more than they're at home when they're young. They're socializing with their peers and their superiors more than they're socializing with their parents when they're young. Because let's be frank, parents work, kids go to school. Once they hit a certain age, they don't even have babysitters at home. You know, it's definitely something that needs to change. And this step that California is taking
is a big one.
Is a big step towards making some of those changes. Now we just need all the other 49 states that are left to get on board with the same thing. We can't deny that LGBTQ people exist. And educating our youth about LGBTQ history and health and things like that will not turn heterosexual students into LGBTQ students. It just won't. They might become allies.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic. So, on that depressive note in the news, the good part is that there's change happening, and change is important.
Change is good.
So now, let's do story time.
Story time. So we really want to, we know we talk a lot about personal experiences in our podcast. If you've been listening since the beginning, or if you're just now catching up, you know, Atlas and I talk a lot about our own experiences, but I think I want to start trying to bring in a bit more personal so you guys can really get to know us and what we're about. So I'm going to start implementing a story of the week. And next week, we might end up structuring our episodes a little bit differently until we find something that we really like. But for our story of the week, we're just going to talk about our week a little bit and kind of see where we're at. That's the longest drum roll ever, but I'll take it.
Hey, I found one longer. Oh, God. It's still doing it. I'm so sorry. That's the longer one. Let's keep going. That works.
So, I mean, we're obviously very goofy here in our house. But this week in Atlas and Sheba news, probably the biggest thing that happened this week, there's two really big things that happened this week. The first one was that I got accepted to my dream school. So I am going to be going back to college.
Congratulations.
30 and going back to college and going into more student debt. But
you got accepted. You got to do it now.
This is actually what I want to do. And, you know, I've been to college 3 times now. Once actually resulting in a degree that I wanted, but I didn't want. I didn't want to go into $30,000 worth of student debt for that degree. And I didn't need it, but I did. This time I'm going back for what I actually want to go to school for. And it's my dream fucking college, you guys. I got accepted to my dream college, which just goes to show that you don't need to be right out of high school to go to college and get accepted to your dream school. This has been my dream school since I was in high school. And
I'm jealous because it's been my dream school since high school as well, but I'm going to apply for the spring semester.
So. There you go. Next other big news. Also in big news this week, it was Atlas's birthday.
Oh, shucks.
He turned 42.
I'm ancient.
This weekend. And we had a really good time. I took him out to an arcade. We went out to a really fancy dinner. And it was generally all in all a good time. He went to a Magic the Gathering event the night before.
Yep.
And he got a lot of presents that he didn't expect because someone told me he didn't want any presents for his birthday, which was not going
to
happen.
I don't want to keep getting older. I wanted to just ignore it.
But he needs to know that he is celebrated and that his existence is something worth celebrating and that getting older is going to happen whether you want it to or not. So
I will say it felt really nice to be on the front burner, so to speak. And in the past, in my past relationships, I've been in very unhealthy, non-communicatory, gaslighty bad relationships, and my birthday was always on the back burner and occasionally forgotten entirely,
which is awful.
So it was really like very touching and meant the world to me. So thank you, Sheba.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. Other than story of the week, I got nothing. That was like the thing. So anyway, kind of going back to what our topic was, ethical non-monogamy. If you have questions, reach out to us. We already shouted out our socials, but again, Facebook, Twitter, Patreon,
our website,
relationshipumbrella.com, our email, therelationshipumbrella@gmail.com. Get a hold of us. We want to hear from you. Do you have questions for us, about us, or about a specific topic? Please shout it out to us. We want to have a segment where we answer all your questions for the week. We want to hear from you. And so get to our socials.
If you can do it this week with our next episode being on communication,
we'll shout you out.
We'll shout you out. We'll answer as many questions as we can.
Super important.
Super important. If we don't get any questions, well, damn it, that sucks. We'll still keep pushing for questions. We'll work
on it. But at the end of the day, no matter what kind of life you practice, whether you're straight or gay or monogamous or polyamorous or whatever, anywhere in between,
fall anywhere on the beautiful spectrum of LGBTQ,
just remember that you are valid,
you are loved,
and you are seen. We love you guys. We'll see you next week.
Bye.